Isaiah chapter 8 verse 1 to chapter 10 verse 4, the eighth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on April 29, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Isaiah chapters 8 and 9 and a little bit of 10. I'm looking for a landing place because today's the last week that I'll be doing it in this series for a while. Last week, I took a little rabbit trail, and I talked about how Matthew, in his gospel, uses the Old Testament, and in particular, he uses Isaiah a number of times. So I talked about his uses of the passages in the Old Testament and passages in Isaiah that we've already encountered as we're working through Isaiah. And what I argued is that there are instances where Matthew interprets the passages in Isaiah as being predictive, but there are various kinds of predictions. I could predict that the world will end on December 12th of this year. That would be a fairly specific and dramatic thing if it happened, if the prediction came true. There are other predictions that I could make, such as the sun will rise tomorrow morning, that's less dramatic. It's still a prediction, but it's less dramatic. And it's less, So there are a number of predictions. Matthew reads a number of predictions in Isaiah, interprets in Isaiah to be a number of predictions. Some of them are quite specific, but others are not as impressive. They're more general, but nevertheless, they're predictive. So there are those kinds of passages, but what I argued is there's another kind of passage that occurs in Isaiah that's also important to Matthew, and that is foreshadowings. It's when something happens, when God orchestrates something to happen in history that foreshadows an event that is yet to come, in which some of those same elements will be brought together in a more profound way. And I argued that there are a number of places in Isaiah where that is happening, and I think not only in Isaiah but elsewhere in the Old Testament, that are used by the New Testament authors to show that there is a coherence to history. There is an author, and there is a coherence to what's happening in history. And we can see that because the themes that get developed, they keep coming up in different ways and then tied together in the final conclusion. Okay, so we talked about that last week, and now we'll jump back into the march through Isaiah. And I want to look at chapter 8, but before I do, let me talk a little bit about the historical background in a little bit more detail. I've already mentioned that when Uzziah died in 742, that was a fairly portentous time, that people sensed that there were things that were going to be changing in the Middle East and didn't know exactly where they were going to go, but it looked a little bit ominous. That's because there were four kings who were all replaced in a short period of time, in a five-year period of time. And whenever a king dies or is replaced, there's always a period of a little bit of shakiness when the new king takes power. And the four kings were the king of Israel, Jeroboam II died. The king of Aram died, and the king of Assyria died, and they were all replaced. Then Uzziah, the king of Judah, dies and is replaced. So it's four kings within a five-year period of time. In Israel, so in the northern kingdom, Let me describe what's happening there because I think it's significant for the passage we're looking at today. Jeroboam died in 746. After he died, there was a period of extreme turmoil and even civil war in the northern kingdom. There were five kings in a period of 10 years, and three of those took power by violence. There were two kings that took power within a short period of time after Jeroboam had died, and then a third king, Menachem, came to power. He reigned for, I think, 7 years. Yes. He reigned for 7 years. So that was the most stable part of this 10-year period of time. Then when he dies, there's another dynastic dispute. His successor reigns for just a short period of time. And then a commander in the military, Pekah, and that's the name that we've seen already, Pekah takes power, having killed Menachem, he takes power and becomes the king. It would appear that Pekah probably took power with the help of Aram. And historians think that because Menachem had, in the face of the threat of the Assyrians coming, Menachem had decided that he would begin paying tribute to the Assyrians. So every year, a certain amount of the taxes that were gathered, and usually such tribute was pretty onerous, that had to go to Assyria. And Menachem decided to do that rather than to risk an invasion by the Assyrians. And there was great resistance to that within Israel. No country likes to do that, and in this particular point in time, the people of Israel, there was stiff resistance in some quarters to that. So when he dies, it is thought that Pekah, with the help of the Arameans, killed the successor, whose name was Pekahiah, killed him, and then Pekah became the king. And as soon as he became king, he became one of the leaders in developing an anti-Assyrian alliance with Aram. So that's apparently what happened. So Pekah is now in power. They cut off their ties with Assyria, and they work on building this anti-Assyrian alliance. But the unrest continues within the northern kingdom. So for 10 years, for much of that 10-year period of time, Israel is experiencing civil war. And it's a nasty civil war. The few glimpses of it that we get in 2 Kings indicates that there were a number of atrocities that were committed. In the south then, Uzziah, who had not started to pay tribute to the Assyrians at this point in time, but had also not entered into an anti-Assyrian alliance. He dies, he's replaced by his son Jotham, and Jotham also is unwilling to join the anti-Assyrian alliance. And as a result of that, Jotham rules for about 7 years. During the end of that 7-year period of time, apparently the northern kingdom and Aram begin to take military action against Judah. So when Jotham dies, Ahaz becomes the king, and it's a very volatile situation. Aram and Israel are both wanting to take advantage of a new and young king and depose him and replace him with a king that is pro-anti-Assyrian alliance. So he's in a difficult situation, a very difficult situation. Judah isn't all that strong. Israel has a much larger population, is wealthier, and is stronger militarily. and then you add Aram to that, and you also have to add the Philistines to that, who are also kind of side players in this anti-Assyrian coalition. So Ahaz is scared, and we see his fear coming out in his religious practices. He worships the gods, several gods, the gods of all of the neighboring peoples. His response to the situation out of his fear is to diversify his religious portfolio. That is to say, he's not going to invest very deeply in any god. He's just going to invest lightly in a whole bunch of gods. That's in that way he's protecting himself the best. God doesn't like diversified religious portfolios. He's a jealous God. He likes people who are fully invested in him and him alone. So Ahaz is in a difficult situation. You can see why he's afraid. Early in his reign, they're going to be the events that we'll be talking about happen within the first 3 years of his reign. We know that he was invaded by armies from Aram and Israel, probably in that first 3 year period of time. And so probably very early, probably the first year, year and a half. And we know that he suffered significant defeats at the hands of each of them. Against Israel, we know that he lost 120,000 men, and there were 200,000 taken captive, but those captives were returned at the insistence of a prophet. It's at this point in time, then, that Isaiah comes to Ahaz the first time, and that's in chapter 7 that we see that, where Isaiah comes to Ahaz and says, trust God. Trust God through this. Don't trust the foreign powers. Don't trust the foreign gods. Trust God and God alone. And Ahaz at that time Isaiah gives Ahaz a sign that there will be a child born, a boy whose name will be Emmanuel, which means God is with us. And Emmanuel is going to live in their midst and be a reminder to them that of what Isaiah predicted, and that was that before the time that he could tell good and evil, and scholars think that's probably about the age of 13, that he would be eating honey and curds, suggesting that the population would be greatly reduced in the area, and so those foods would be available, and that Aram and Israel would be forsaken. In other words, what Isaiah is saying, don't worry about those two countries. I know they look ominous right now, but don't worry about them. They will soon be gone. Okay, and it's at that point then that the action in chapter 8 takes place. Verses 1 through 4. Then the Lord said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write it in ordinary letters. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. And I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. So I approached the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Then the Lord said to me, name him Maher-shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to cry out, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. In order for the chronology to work, this has to have happened within months, maybe a year, after the first time that he appears before Ahaz. Before he had appeared before Ahaz and given Ahaz a sign, now he's doing something that's more public and doing something that's for the people as a whole, for the commoners. And we've seen that before in Isaiah. Several times Isaiah has indicated that the leaders are culpable for what has happened. They will be held at a greater level of responsibility. But the common people are also culpable. And that's double stress. But there's frequently that emphasis on the leaders. So Isaiah went first to Ahaz, but now he's going to the people as a whole. And what he's instructed to do is take a tablet, and such tablets have been found, apparently most of them, the biggest collection of them has been found in Assyria. But tablets, and I don't know exactly the dimensions, but I think they're kind of yay so, 18 inches by about 4 or 5 inches. Of the ones that they found in Assyria, some of them were just plain wood that you would write on, and then you could scrape it off and write something else. Some of them were covered with ivory, and you would write on that and then wipe it off, and you could write again. So he's taking a large tablet, and what he's supposed to write on it is this phrase, the Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and that means swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. And that phrase then is going to become the name of another child that is going to be born. I say another child that's going to be born. It's very possible that it's not another child, but it's the same child. It could very well be the same child that was predicted in chapter 7. That in chapter 7 it was said that there a maiden would conceive and give birth to a child, and that child's name would be Emmanuel. But it could very well be that now, just a few months later, what's being predicted is that that same child that was predicted in 7 will be born, but it's going to have another name, a second significance, and will become another clock, but a clock with a shortened time frame. In any case, a child will be born, and we know this time that the child will be born is born to Isaiah himself through his wife, called the prophetess. It's not clear whether she was a prophet in her own right and is therefore called a prophetess, or is called a prophetess because she's the wife of a prophet. That is not clear. We have no other mention of her in the text. She conceives and gives birth to a son, and that son then is named Maher Shalal Hashbaz. The clock now starts ticking as soon as the child is born, because what Isaiah has predicted is that before the child can say, my mother or my father, some of the first words that children typically speak, that the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. So this has greatly shortened the time frame. It's interesting now. We saw in chapter 6 it started out with a time frame of 65 years. Within 65 years, Israel and Aram will be gone. Then with Emmanuel, that was shortened down to about 13 years. Now a few months later, we're shortening that down to a couple of years. I don't know how long it takes kids to learn Hebrew, but in our culture, it would take a couple of years for them to say my mom, my mother, my father. Okay, so now we've got a much shorter time period that we're working with. Verses 5 through 8. And again the Lord spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, now therefore behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck. And the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. I love this image. You have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah. The gently flowing waters of Shiloh would be the Gihon Spring, the spring that provides the water to Jerusalem and has historically provided the water to Jerusalem ever since David took it, took the city. In fact, he took the city using the tunnels that the Jebusites had built to get that water into the city. And the people of Judah have rejected those gently flowing waters of Shiloh. That spring had provided water for the city, the people of Jerusalem, for, I think I could say, for at least a millennium, for a very long time. And in fact, it's still flowing. When we were in, some of you may have gone to the to see the Hezekiah's tunnel. You may have even walked through it. We did. It was quite an experience. But it's carrying the water that's flowing out of that spring, and it just keeps flowing. It's not a huge spring. The channel that you walk through when you're walking through it is about 3 feet wide, and it's at its deepest, it's probably about 18 to 20 inches, maybe 2 feet. So it's not a huge amount of water. It just keeps pumping that water out. Well, that becomes kind of a symbol of God's care for the people of Israel, for the people of Judah. It's not an impressive spring. There are much bigger springs in the world. It doesn't overwhelm them with water. It's just steady. It just keeps just churning that water out. Day after day after day after day. And it's kind of a symbol of the way that God has cared for his people. He hasn't provided them with an overabundance of everything, but he has cared for them. And he has cared for them for a long period of time. And it's that care for them that they had come to take for granted, as Isaiah points out in the first chapter, that the people of Israel didn't recognize who it was that cared for them, who it was that fed them. They took all that for granted. And I think this is essentially that same idea that's being presented with the waters, the gently flowing waters of Shiloh. They would like to have something, they would like to have lots and lots of water. They'd like to have something dramatic, something that's impressive. But that isn't the way God had provided for them. But because they had rejected that, there were big waters coming. The Euphrates was going to overflow its banks, and that water was going to flood the area. It was going to sweep through from Mesopotamia into the Near East, into Palestine, through Israel, and it was even going to enter into Judah and come up to their necks. And that flood was going to be Assyria. Assyria was going to sweep through with all of its glory and swamp the whole area. Then in verse 8, he changes images and says, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land. So now we've got a completely different image, but it's wings spread over the whole extent of Judah. That's a big bird. That's a little ominous. Little ominous. So we've got this flood as one image. We've got the bird, this big bird as another image. All of that is an image of Assyria coming and just overrunning the entire area and overrunning most of Judah, which is historically exactly what happens. But then the last phrase in this section is, O Emmanuel. Hearkening back to what was said in chapter 7, the prediction of the child that would come, that would be a sign, that would be a reminder that God is with us. We can trust him to take care of us. Things may look ominous, but we can trust him to take care of us. Oh, Emmanuel, he's addressing this boy, this sign, this reminder of God's presence. Next section. Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. For thus the Lord spoke to me with mighty power, instructed me not to walk in the ways of this people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy in regard to all that this people calls a conspiracy. And you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. Then he shall become a sanctuary, but to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, and a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many will stumble over them. Then they will fall and be broken. They will even be snared and caught. So now Isaiah starts into a kind of taunt. He's just predicted the coming of Assyria. But lest people be confused that Assyria is something genuinely to be feared, his taunt now is to the peoples of the world, even to all remote places. He says, come on, gird yourselves, that is, get ready, and be shattered, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand. Any nation who thinks that because Assyria was strong and is going to have success against Israel, that they can do that, that they can take history into their hands, they're wrong. Because whoever connives against Israel, apart from God allowing it to happen, it's going to be frustrated. It will not happen. And God is determined and committed to the fact that Israel will not be wiped out. In the last line in verse 11, for God is with us. Well, that again is the word Emmanuel. For Emmanuel, for God is with us. Then God speaks apparently very powerfully and very directly to Isaiah. And what he's saying to Isaiah is, don't respond the way that the people your fellow countrymen have responded. You need to chart a different path. You need to keep things straight in your mind. And he starts out by saying, you are not to say it's a conspiracy in regard to all that these people call a conspiracy. I think what's going on here is living in a time when, if we've reconstructed the history correctly, first Aram conspires to get a new king in Israel in order to build up a bigger anti-Assyrian alliance. And now Aram and Israel are conspiring to defeat Judah and put a new king on the throne of Judah so that that country then will join the anti-Assyrian alliance. This is a time of conspiracies. And those conspiracies appear to be ways in which history can be diverted from its path. It would appear that if you could bring enough countries together, you can steer history in a direction that it would not otherwise go. You can change the course of history. That's what Ahaz is afraid of, and that's what the people of Judah seem to be afraid of as well. Despite God's promises, they're afraid that a conspiracy could change history. And I think what God is saying to Isaiah is, don't be afraid of plans and schemes to change history in such a way that God's purposes aren't fulfilled. It isn't going to happen. So he goes on to say, and you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. For the Lord of hosts, whom you should regard as holy, he shall be your fear and he shall be your dread. So he's the one that is in control of history, firmly in control of history. And no one and no group of people are going to wrest that out of his hands. Given that perspective then, and if one trusts God and his faithfulness to his promises, then he shall become a sanctuary. That for one who understands that and embraces that, God is a sanctuary, a place of safety, a place of refuge. But that will not be the case for most of Israel. For most of Israel, in both houses, that is, in the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, what God is doing, God's behavior, becomes a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, a snare and a trap. That the way that God conducts himself is such that people are prone to stumble over it. They are prone to see that as a problem, an obstacle to believing God and trusting him. We'll talk about that more at the end. Okay, next section. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. I'm not sure what is being referred to here when it says the testimony and the law. I don't know, the law here is the word Torah, which is sometimes used for the first five books of the Old Testament. But what makes the most sense in this context is that the claims that he has just made in this chapter would be the testimony and the law. Law, it can also mean instruction. Torah can also mean instruction. So the testimony and the instruction that is sealed up and entrusted to Isaiah's disciples such that it be kept, not destroyed, and that it not be tampered with, as evidence that what Isaiah had said would come true, it can be looked at in retrospect, yes, it did come true. But it seems to me that that makes the most sense in this context, but it could be talking more broadly about God's scripture in general. Most commentators take it in that direction, and I wouldn't fight them too hard on that. But he's to seal this up and keep it as for future reference, as to evidence of God's faithfulness to the claims that he has made and the promises that he's made. And Isaiah then, and the children that God has given him, so the two boys or the three boys, depending on whether the last two are one or two different boys. He says, I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. In other words, he's recognizing that there's a sense in which God is not being obvious in history. He's hiding his face. Isaiah acknowledges that. It's not easy to see God in history right now because it looks like things are going badly for his people. But he will wait for that God who's hiding his face. He will even look eagerly for him because Isaiah knows that in the end, God will be vindicated. and that Isaiah and his sons were given to Israel to be signs and, my translation says wonders, but it's really signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. So he has come as a witness to God's faithfulness and what God is going to do. Next section. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn. And they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished. And it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. So as difficulties come, as life gets precarious, what's going to happen is people are going to say, in this environment of uncertainty, we can't stand the uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen, so we don't know what decisions to make. In that kind of environment, what people are going to do is they are going to want to know what's going to happen. They will consult the mediums and the spiritists. And they're going to defend their action by saying, should not a people consult their God? But Isaiah's response is, you don't need to consult your God. You have the law and the testimony. You don't need to know more specifically what's going to happen in the future. You've been given the information that you've been given about the future, which is not a lot in some respects. But you've also been given information with respect to who God is. And reason to believe that God is the author of history and it's firmly in his control and that he's committed to his people and committed to the promises that he's made to his people. So to the law and to the testimony, you'll find plenty of reassurance there if you trust the God who spoke those words. And if they, that is, I assume that's the mediums and the spiritists, do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn. The light has not broken through. There's no enlightenment there. There's only darkness. And they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. So, and the they here, I think, has to be the people of Israel in general. So they'll be in very difficult circumstances, hungry, famished even. And when that's the case, they are going to have two curses. One is to the political entity, the king. That will be their first curse, and then God himself. But gaining no satisfaction, having cursed the king and God, they will then turn their eyes downward, and there will be nothing there to give them any hope. They look to the earth, and there's distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. So it's a darkness that comes from refusing to acknowledge God as one who is faithful to his promises and faithful to Israel. Chapter 9. But there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious. By the way of the sea, on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in thy presence as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and righteousness, from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So in chapter 8, things look really gloomy in more ways than one. It's a really dark picture. The people of Israel are immersed in darkness. They can't see. They can't make sense of things. And they have turned their back on God. But in chapter 9, we get a promise. A promise of a way in which that darkness can be dispelled and will be dispelled. That darkness is first going to be dispelled in the northern part of Israel. It's the area of Galilee, upper and lower Galilee. That would be the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. And it says that it was, in earlier times, he treated this land with contempt. I'm not sure exactly what that means, whether it just means that it wasn't treated as a significant part of the land of Israel, that it never had anything to distinguish it. That could very well be the case. We know that in New Testament times, that seems to be the attitude towards that area. But in any case, he has picked an area that had no distinction, that had no thing that made it significant, and it will take on a great significance. That is, that's where they will see a great light, and the darkness will first be dispelled. A light is going to shine on them, and they will become glad in God's presence as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. So it's like finally something to really rejoice about. The darkness has been dispelled, and things are right. There are three reasons given for the gladness that they're experiencing. The first is because the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders will be broken. And this is as had happened at the Battle of Midian. At the Battle of Midian, the Midianites had oppressed the Israelites for an extended period of time during the period of the Judges. And Gideon was raised up by God to fight against them. And you'll recall the story of Gideon, where there were a large number of men, and he narrowed it down to just 300 men, I think, finally, who go to fight against the Midianites and defeat them. And that then ends the oppression of the Midianites. So that yoke of their burden is going to be broken. That will be the first reason for rejoicing. The second, every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult, the cloak rolled in blood, will be for burning. In other words, war will be over. There will be no more warriors. There will be no more need for the equipment of a warrior. And the third, because a child will be born to us. And this is not just any child. This is a son. And that could have messianic content built into it. A son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. I suspect that there is a lot packed into these names, but at the very least, out of these four names, the first one points to his wisdom, Mighty Counselor. The second, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, points to his power. Third, Eternal Father, points to his eternality, the endless, his reign without end. And Prince of Peace, pointing out the lack of conflict. And I think that means ultimately the conflict between God and man. So this is the promise of one who is to come, who will sit on the throne of David, who will rule over God's people, and who will institute a reign which is characterized by wisdom, power, eternality, and peace. And it will be a just and righteous reign. And we know that this will come to pass because God is committed to it. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So that is pointing to a glorious future that awaits Israel and its people, which takes the edge off of the gloomy prediction that just preceded it. Next section. And the Lord sends a message against Jacob, and it falls on Israel, and all the people know it, that is Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, asserting in pride and in arrogance of heart, "The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace them with cedars." Therefore, the Lord raises against them adversaries from Rezin and spurs their enemies on, the Arameans on the east and the Philistines on the west, and they devour Israel with gaping jaws. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. So God sends a message against Jacob. It falls on Israel. So this is to the northern kingdom. And in the northern kingdom, apparently the dominant spirit is one of arrogance. And that arrogance manifests itself in the attitude that we don't have to worry. Whatever happens to us, we will rebuild and it will be even better than it was before. What was built of bricks, they will build of stones. The sycamores that are cut down, they'll replace with cedars. So they can, no matter what happens to them, they can overcome that and actually do better. They can better their situation. And I think that that's kind of in defiance of God. You can't do anything to us that we can't come out of and undo. So it says in 11, "Therefore the Lord raises against them adversaries," literally it's adversaries of Rezin, "and spurs their enemies on, the Arameans in the west, in the east, and the Philistines in the east." So in response to their arrogance and kind of defiance before God, he's going to raise up enemies from both the east and the west who are going to come against them. It's not clear whether it's the adversaries of Rezin, which would be Assyria, or Rezin being Aram itself. But enemies are going to come from both directions, the east and the west, and they are going to devour Israel with gaping jaws. So a judgment is coming against the northern kingdom because of their arrogance. And then it ends with this little refrain that's going to be repeated four times. And it We saw it already in, I think it was chapter 5, where the same refrain was used. And it says, in spite of all his anger, in spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. God is going to keep putting on the pressure. Things are going to keep coming down the pike, sufferings that they are going to have to endure because of their continued arrogance. So there's more coming. Verse 13, yet the people do not turn back to him who struck them, nor do they seek the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cuts off head and tail from Israel, both palm branch and bulrush, in a single day. The head is the elder and honorable man, and the prophet who teaches falsehood is the tail. For those who guide this people are leading them astray, and those who are guided by them are brought to confusion. Therefore the Lord does not take pleasure in their young men, nor does he have pity on their orphans or their widows. For every one of them is godless and an evildoer, and every mouth is speaking foolishness. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. So the second phase of this judgment is that he is going to cut off and destroy the leadership of Israel in a single day. The elder and the honorable man, the prophet, and the prophet who teaches falsehood, all of those are going to be taken away in a single day. And historically, when the Assyrians come in, they do take the leadership of Israel out of Israel, and they move them into other parts of the Assyrian realm empire. In this absence of leadership, then, we're going to have a situation in which the young men, the orphans, and the widows all suffer. In fact, everyone will suffer as a result of God's wrath because of their foolishness. The next section, 18 through 21. For wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It even sets the thickets of the forest aflame, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. By the fury of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned up, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. And they slice off what is on the right hand, but still are hungry. And they eat what is on the left hand, but they are not satisfied. Each of them eats the flesh of his own arm. Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh, and together they are against Judah. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. So as the difficulties for Israel, the northern kingdom, continue, now we've got a situation in which I think it's civil war that's being described here. Wickedness comes in like a fire, and it consumes everything, and it spreads such that no man spares his brother. So they start becoming cannibalistic in a sense. I don't think it means literally, but in a sense they're cannibalistic. That is to say, they go around slashing what's on their right arm to eat, slashing what's on their left arm to eat, thinking that they are providing for their needs, but in fact, they are destroying themselves. I think that's the picture that we're to get. So it's people turning themselves on their brothers, people turning themselves on their own. Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh, and together they are against Judah. So everybody against everybody else. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. There's one more phase to this, the first part of chapter 10. Woe to those who enact evil statutes, and to those who constantly record unjust decisions, so as to deprive the needy of justice, and rob the poor of my people of their rights. in order that widows may be their spoil, and that they may plunder the orphans. Now what will you do in the day of punishment, and in the devastation which will come from afar? To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your wealth? Nothing remains but to crouch among the captives or fall among the slain. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. God is outraged at the lack of concern for justice in their midst. It's those who constantly record unjust decisions and deprive the needy of justice, rob the poor of their rights, and so that the widows may be their spoil, and that they may plunder the orphans. So they're taking advantage of those who are least capable of defending themselves. God is outraged at that. As a result, this punishment that is coming, the Assyrian invasion that's coming, is going to leave them in a situation where they will be fleeing for help, but they will have no place to go. They'll want to store their wealth, but there'll be no place to leave it where it can be safe. They will be in the situation in which the orphans and widows are in, as they are taking advantage of those orphans and widows. They will be just as vulnerable, and yet there will be no place for them to turn. They will have no choice but to be either among the captives or be in the pile of dead bodies. And then, once again, in spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. Okay, just a couple of things with respect to this section. The first is, it's interesting to me how Isaiah throughout here, and he will continue to do this, he will have a section in which he talks about the coming wrath that God is sending on them. And it can look very, very grim. But he always ends that with, he always follows that with a section that talks about the glory of Israel yet to come. And he just keeps cycling through that. He never allows it to get to the place where it looks hopeless, because it isn't hopeless. There's always a hope that's yet standing out there. And it's also interesting that in so doing, every time he talks about the wrath that's coming, he paints it a little bit differently. And every time he talks about the glorious future, he paints it a little bit differently, so that it fills that picture out slowly. And you can get a better understanding of what it is that Isaiah is anticipating happening. The other thing that I find interesting here is his discussion of the stumbling block. When God comes to Isaiah and says that he doesn't want Isaiah to walk in the way of this people, this is in the middle of chapter 8, then he goes on to say that for Isaiah, who trusts in God, God will be a sanctuary. But for the rest of the people, God will be a stumbling block, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, etc. In the context that we're talking about right here, God is a stumbling block in the sense that what the people would like to have is God acting dramatically on their behalf. They would like to have that kind of assurance that God is taking care of things, and they would like to for God to do away with all of their anguish and discomfort. God isn't doing that. And what God is doing is, in response to the rebelliousness that we talked about, that Isaiah describes in chapter 1, their refusal to recognize the care and concern that God gives to the people of Israel on a daily basis, that kind of quiet, gently flowing waters of the Siloah. That's the way God has provided for them, and they've taken that for granted. They'd like something more. And God isn't providing that something more. In fact, he is going to make life harder. He's going to cause them to suffer because of that rebelliousness to get their attention. And by doing that, God is running a risk. He's running a huge risk that in so doing, they will not understand that as a continuation of his love and concern for them and discipline, the discipline that it is, and they will see that as God either being not loving or God not being there. In that sense, then, God has become a stumbling block. He's become a stumbling block because he's not providing for them the way they would like to be provided for. We as creatures would like God to be our servant, and the God who is not our servant. It is just the other way around. But the fact that he will not be our servant is a stumbling block and a snare for us as human beings. We would really like him to dance to our tune. Okay, questions or comments?
David, in the Emmanuel, or the son that mm-hmm. was promised in chapter 7, that is a son of Isaiah? Is that...
It's not certain that that is the case, but it seems probable that he's the son of Isaiah. It's also quite possible that he is the same child as the one that's named Maher Shalal Hashbash, that Emmanuel and Maher are both the same child.
Okay, but that child does not have messianic overtones or whatever. As the one in, what was it, chapter 8? Mm-hmm.
Where it says a son will be born,
yes.
A child will be born.
Yes.
In chapter 9.
So that one, it sounded like you didn't have any problem with that being
I believe that is messianic.
Okay.
That whole section, I believe, is predictive of something that will happen in the future, and Jesus is the fulfillment of that prediction.
Okay, but not the one in 7.
No, I don't believe so. I don't think that's predictive.
Okay.
But that is, I believe, a foreshadowing. That is to say, God brought that, orchestrated that event such that it contains some elements that are going to be more profoundly realized in the birth of Jesus. So it's not predictive. You couldn't look at chapter 7 and say, oh, I know what's going to happen. Jesus is going to be born. But you can look at chapter 7 after Jesus has been born and say, oh, he didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, there was some preparation in history. There were some things that suggested the coming of Jesus and what he was going to do before he came. So the distinction that I'm making is what happens in 7 is not predictive. You can only see it after the fact. What's talked about in chapter 9, I think, is genuinely predictive.
Okay. And then more of a comment than a question. When you were saying that Israel didn't really see God because he was kind of working behind the scenes, or I think that that's very applicable to our own lives. A lot of times, I mean, if we think that God is not working in our lives because there's not a big bang or some fantastic stuff that's happening, but we just are going through life missing a lot of the stuff that he provides for us that we just start taking for granted.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
When you speak of Israel having this attitude of wanting more, is that the leaders that are being addressed as far as who Israel is, or is that the whole body of people in that they are all convinced that how they are being led is the correct way, or could you?
Well, I think clearly Isaiah is holding both groups responsible, that the leaders are being held responsible for their rebelliousness, and the commoners are also held responsible for their rebelliousness. It's a society as a whole. And I'm convinced that you can't have rulers in a society that take that society in a direction that the population as a whole doesn't want to go. That it's really kind of all of a piece. We have so much impact on each other that it's all of a piece. Had there been good rulers, they might have been able to influence the people to go a different direction. Maybe, maybe not. But this rebelliousness is something that's pervasive throughout the society, rulers and commoners. And what they want is, I can identify with this very well. I mean, wouldn't we like God to be dramatically present in our lives, taking care of the problems that we see in our life that we aren't sure how those are going to get resolved? Wouldn't we love it if we could snap our fingers and God would do that for us? I mean, that's the kind of God we want. That's not the kind of God that is. And it's that juxtaposition that's so difficult. It's humbling ourselves to being the servant, recognizing that is our position. God is taking care of us the way that he knows that is good for us, that he ought to take care of us. We just need to recognize what he's doing rather than chafe at the way that he's relating to us. And I think that's what we have pervasive in the society. That's the nature of the rebelliousness.
Just a real quick question about the style of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
As you were reading, it sounded less like Isaiah recording his thoughts and more like an observer recording what Isaiah said.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any indication as to whether Isaiah was penning these words or he had a biographer?
To my knowledge, I haven't seen discussion of that. As I recall, I have not studied Jeremiah, but as I recall, Jeremiah had someone write down his words. We don't have an indication where it's explicitly stated that Isaiah had someone writing down his words. The style here is very difficult. You'll be going along looking at something that is purportedly something that God said, and then you'll see a line where it's clearly Isaiah saying it, and it'll go back and forth between God speaking and Isaiah speaking without any warning. And I think what's happening there is Isaiah is so speaking for God that the two are really intertwined, and it's hard to extricate what is Isaiah's contribution, unique contribution, and what is God's unique contribution. And I think the style is intended to convey that kind of thing. But the sense that this is someone more distant from Isaiah, I haven't thought about that, and I don't know what I can say with respect to that. But this is difficult. Stylistically, this is difficult to sort out. Anything else?
David, do you have any thoughts on how the messianic passage in chapter 9 is going to be fulfilled. I mean, obviously right now Israel doesn't have a monarchy. Mm-hmm. So what would it mean to sit on the throne of David? Will there be a monarchy in the future, literal, physical? Or is this more of a metaphorical in language?
I'm assuming that he will sit on the throne of David, that the monarchy somehow will be reestablished. He will actually sit on the throne of David. Whether that's warranted or not, I'm not sure, but that's the picture I have. Okay, thanks.